The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Martha Potter from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State Magazine. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting this podcast for over 15 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. Today, we'll continue to dig more into the main theme of the June issue of Our State Magazine, which is all about North Carolina's lighthouses. The first article that I'll read to you is called Lighthouse in the Dark. Cape Lookout Lighthouse once guided ships safely through treacherous shoals. Today, it's the centerpiece of one of the darkest places on the Atlantic coastline, thanks to a group of Down East stargazers. And the lead picture here is a star-filled night and looking up at the lighthouse and the keeper's house into a star-filled sky. Cape Lookout Lighthouse was built in 1859 to help mariners find their way through the darkness of the southern Outer Banks. Today, that darkness draws stargazers who marvel at the Milky Way and other cosmic wonders. Excuse me. Before the sun's glow completely vanishes from Harker's Island, our neighboring planet Venus appears as if a light switch was flipped on 24 million miles away. It's not always easy to spot, but a group of dedicated stargazers locates the tiny speck of light instantly as they set up 14 telescopes at the Cape Lookout National Seashore Visitor Center. They've invited the public to experience one of the darkest skies in the state and on the country's Atlantic coastline. It's the Crystal Coast Stargazers' second annual Star Party, a celebration of Cape Lookout National Seashore's official International Dark Sky Park certification in 2021. One stargazer with windswept hair and crescent moon earrings is eagerly setting up their telescope. Vermadel Ninstedt has awaited this weekend for months. She's one of the stargazers who helped apply for grants to spread the word, invited NASA scientists to speak, and reached out to every stargazing group in the state. "I started praying for the weather a long time ago," she said. "I told the preacher one day at church," I said. "Patton prayed for good weather for battle. Then I said, 'Forgive me for praying for good weather.'" She and her husband, Jimmy, aimed their telescope west, just above the Core Sound Waterfowl Museum and Heritage Center. As night settles in, cars fill the nearby parking lot, and small lines begin to form at each telescope. For a moment, Ninstedt leaves her station and walks through the maze of stargazers. She stops by fellow stargazer Bob Harrison, who's guiding his laser pointer in a circle around a faraway object that looks just like dust in the sky. "Who wants to see a galaxy?" Harrison asks. The small boy in front of him can barely contain himself. "I want to see a galaxy," the child exclaims. Banks, a 5-year-old from nearby Davis, leaps toward the telescope. He lines his eye according to Harris's instructions, and the boy's expression takes on a look of wonder as the cluster of stars and planets come into focus. It's nearly a new moon, which is the perfect time of the month for stargazing, weather permitting, because the moon is a natural source of light pollution and can drown out other nearby stars. But seasoned stargazers like these know that the moon is important for people to see, too. "I once had a woman cry from seeing the moon through my scope," Brandon Porter says, as he adjusted his telescope beside Ninstedt's. Porter, an active member of the Crystal Coast Stargazers and one of 5 NASA Solar System ambassadors in the group, has pointed his scope just south of Ninstedt's to show visitors the Orion Nebula. As the famous Greek hunter reveals himself, Porter points out the nebula below Orion's belt. "When it gets really dark," he says, "we can see the edge of the Milky Way." But it's already really dark. So dark that you can barely see your hand if you hold it in front of you. So dark that the stargazers' laser pointers look like they hit planets. So dark that you can see the curvature of the Earth as stars drape down toward the sea. Before dark skies became a modern luxury, they were a problem, one that cost many their lives. The Cape Lookout Lighthouse was first built in 1812 on the southernmost tip of Core Banks, not too far from popular ports like Morehead City and Beaufort. Since the 17th century, merchants and sailors in the whaling and fishing industries had navigated these waters to reach settlements like Diamond City on Shackleford Banks, where salted mullet were a coveted export. Others were forced to maneuver the banks to seek protection from storms. All crews faced the same dangers as they approached the narrow strips of sand between Ocracoke and Beaufort Inlets. Deadly shoals, unforgiving currents, and unpredictable weather conditions. A 1590 map of Cape Lookout named this area Promontorium Tremendum, which translates to Horrible Headland or Cape Terrible. Without a guiding light to see where they were or what lay ahead of them, countless ships ran aground just miles from the coast. In 1804, Congress allocated money for a lighthouse near the pitch of Cape Lookout. The original 100-foot octagonal lighthouse was too short and too dim, so a second was built in 1859, and it still stands today. The light brought clarity and safety to mariners who used the Labrador and Gulf Stream currents along with the stars to find their way into North Carolina. For thousands of years, people have been connected to the night sky, says Nate Tering, the chief of interpretation and education at Cape Lookout National Seashore. Constellations were used for navigational purposes. With the lighthouse and the stars guiding them, seafarers could access the coast without risking their lives. Over the years, however, the world around Cape Lookout brightened, and a new threat came to light. This time, it was the darkness that needed saving. Nennstadt is a Down East native, and a proud one at that. Her mother, originally from Williston, moved to Beaufort when she met Nennstadt's father, who owned Peterson's Grocery and Meat Market. As a child, Nennstadt would peer up at the stars, never thinking of anything of how rare it would become to see so many. She assumed that hers was the sky that everyone saw at night. It wasn't until she moved away from Carteret County to Columbia, South Carolina, that she realized that not all night skies are created equal. I can appreciate more now after having lived off, as we say here, she says. Whenever she and her husband traveled, they'd always visit an observatory or planetarium and explore different night skies across the country. I think that might be a leftover baby boomer thing as we came through the 50s and 60s watched the moon missions, she said. When the couple retired, they moved back home and with their newfound free time decided to take up stargazing regularly. They joined the Crystal Coast Stargazers and began visiting Cape Lookout each month during the new moon. On one of those outings beneath thousands of stars, the group president made a bold assertion. I think we can get this place dark sky certified. Bold because there are only 86 international dark sky parks in the United States. Bold because it takes years to get a park certified. Bold, because in the 23 years that Dark Sky International has been recognizing dark skies, no place along the Atlantic seaboard has ever been dark enough to achieve certification. But people who spend their free time looking at galaxies and faraway planets aren't afraid of uncharted territory. Like Nennstadt, Nate Tering grew up across the country in densely populated Southern California. As a child, whenever he looked up at the night sky, he'd see one or two stars, if he was lucky. He knew there was more to discover out there, and he set off to find it. He began a career in park services and went from Northern California to Alaska, to Moores Creek National Battlefield in Pender County. He came to Cape Lookout in 2017 to lead a team of volunteers giving lighthouse tours. Sometimes on the job, while preparing for the season's start, Tering would sleep in the keeper's quarters on Cape Lookout near the lighthouse. Around 4 a.m. on one of his overnight stays, he headed to the water and took a seat in the sand. It was nearly pitch black, but he knew that he was only one on the beach for miles. You can hear the waves coming and crashing in front of you, he says. There's very minimal trees or terrain or anything to block your vision, and you just see stars in every direction. Way out there, when the conditions are right, you can see the haze of the Milky Way hang in the sky. When the Crystal Coast Stargazers reached out to the park superintendent, Jeff West, with their mission to get Cape Lookout certified, West, Taring, and the rest of the park staff were immediately on board. Over the next 2 years, park staff and the stargazers measured and documented the darkness in the park from all angles. Taring and Nenstadt spent hours in a golf cart wheeling around Harker's Island, armed with a list of every single light in the 56 miles of seashore. They even climbed ladders to inspect lights on buildings. Lights that weren't dark sky approved were replaced or taken down. Dim red lights are used throughout the park to illuminate paths during nighttime events, and the stargazers have adapted similar lights to mark the tripods for their telescopes to limit artificial light. After the park went through a complete light renovation, Nenstadt made the rounds in Carteret County, sharing the story of how the park and the stargazers came together to achieve the first international dark sky park certification on the Atlantic, and why that matters. Marine life on the coast relies on darkness for survival. Turtle hatchlings can't find their way to the ocean from their beach nests if the sky is too bright. Light pollution can negatively impact the ability of some bat species to consume their steady diet of mosquitoes. More than 250 bird species have been found at the park, and those that migrate at night, like plover, have trouble navigating light-polluted skies. There's a lot of small sea life that feed along the shores at night, Nenstadt said. So when it's too bright, first of all, it messes up their day-night cycles, and second of all, they come out and they're easily seen by prey and wiped out. Nenstadt and park staff, like Taring, share this information with the public and through events like the Star Party, invite them to come experience the darkness for themselves. Tonight, Venus's glow grows stronger as the Star Party carries on. Countless specks of light fill the sky above the group, which is gathered at the edge of Back Sound. 4 miles south, the flickering light from Cape Lookout doesn't rotate as it used to. It was just 7 years ago that the lighthouse received LED lighting and became solar-powered, the first in North Carolina to make the switch, saving the park energy and reducing the light's range by 10 nautical miles. Between exclamations from visitors peering into scopes, a silent sense of wonder and awe spreads over the crowd. Although they've all gathered to celebrate a national recognition, it's like everyone here is sharing a coastal secret, one that generations of sailors discovered while following the light of Cape Lookout, one that Nenstadt grew up with and returned to, one that Taring traveled hundreds of miles for, and one that Porter has seen bring people to tears. From where these stargazers stand, the future is bright. Cape Lookout Lighthouse is currently closed for repairs, but you can learn more about the Crystal Coast Stargazers at CC, for Crystal Coast, ccgazers.com. The Cape Lookout Lighthouse on Harker's Island Visitor Center is located on Island Road in Harker's Island, at the end of the point. And you can find more information on the National Park Service website, nps.gov. We'll switch gears a little bit here and talk about dancing on the sand. A music trend that originated on the North Carolina coast evolved into a popular genre and dance that celebrated in New Hanover County each summer. Mike Worley, MC of the Carolina Beach Music Festival, walks through a sunscreen-scented sea of 4,000 people at Carolina Beach. He heads toward the boardwalk stage, stopping along the way to speak with folks huddled under beach umbrellas and taking in the unofficial soundtrack of the festivals. Cold cans cracking open, waves crashing in the distance, and revelers sharing stories about last night's crowd at the Sea Witch Tiki Bar and plans to attend the shag contest at the Lazy Pirate. The festival has been a summer mainstay in this New Hanover town since the 1980s, around the time the area was forming a small but prominent music scene. Decades before, during the days of Jim Crow, white families would drive by a small black community called Seabreeze on their way to Carolina Beach. Two white brothers from Durham, Chicken and Bobby Hicks, moved to the seaside town in the 40s. Chicken would occasionally leave for nights of music and dancing, taking a skiff up to Seabreeze through Snow's Cut to listen to race music like those of blues shouter Winoni Harris and Jasmine Lyle Hampton, who played at juke joints. Due to segregation, this music wasn't playing in Carolina Beach. Chicken eventually convinced white venues in town to play records by black musicians. In white clubs, it was called beach music. Over subsequent decades, beach music became to embrace black and white musical styles, including big band, soul, country, and southern rock. With this new trend came a new dance, the Carolina Shag. It's sort of a descendant of the jitterbug, where dance partners glide along the floor, or the sand, in a six-count, eight-step pattern. By the time the festival began, Carolina Beach was the place in North Carolina for beach music and shagging. Worley found his love for the genre through beach music radio, the same way many lifelong fans in the state have. Before he was introducing bands to thousands of beach lovers at the Carolina Beach Music Festival, he was listening to those groups in the family's barn in the Johnston County town of Princeton. When the Worleys grilled out on Saturdays or worked in the yard on Sundays, the voices of beach music radio icons Steve Hardy and Charlie Bird were always in the background. Worley has been emceeing the music festival since 2011, and the excitement that he shares with the crowd never fades. In old country terms, you're spraying ether in the carburetor, he says. He means you're getting it fired up. On this sunny afternoon, Worley gets the fans on their feet and cheering as he introduces the Band of Oz. The band launches into crowd-pleasing renditions of classics like Ocean Boulevard and Shamalama Ding Dong. The audience sings and shags along to the carefree melodies. Worley joins the crowd on the sand and watches one of his favorite bands kick off the largest beach music festival on the North Carolina coast that's actually hosted on the beach. Around him is a mix of young and old, locals and vacationers, shaggers and beach chair foot tappers, all here to enjoy a Carolina tradition that ushered in an era of coastal harmony. The Carolina Beach Music Festival actually has already taken place. It was June 1. Maybe for next year you can check it out at Carolina. It's at Carolina Beach, and they have a Facebook page, Carolina Beach Music Festival Facebook page. The next article talks about a perennial favorite in the Carolinas called hush puppies. Don't let the name fool you. Yes, there are a few dogs in this story, but the history of North Carolina's favorite fried side dish can't be told without shrimp, soft-shell crabs, and Piedmont smoked hogs, too. The birthplace of hush puppies has been contested, but many believe they first found popularity on the docks lining the Calabash River. In the 1940s, before it became the seafood capital of the world, Calabash was a tiny fishing town where locals would cast nets off the dock or launch boats into the river to catch their next meal. When fishermen would return on hot summer afternoons, their families would gather beneath shady live oaks to peel shrimp and fillet fish before tossing everything in a light breading and submerging it in pots of fry oil. During these fish fries, there was often extra breading, and North Carolinians aren't one to waste. The dockside cooks combined the cornmeal with other leftovers and then fried the mixture for a hearty side. Plus, if you believe in the legend, something to toss to the pups that began barking when they smelled the feast. As the fish fries moved indoors, the matriarchs of soon-to-be legendary seafood houses, Coleman's, Beck's, Ella's, began serving hush puppies to customers alongside platters of fried oysters, flounder, crab, and shrimp. About 200 miles west of Calabash, the Friendly Road Inn in Greensboro, which opened in the early 1950s, was introducing the concept of the fish fry to local customers. And some big names, like restaurateur Warner Stamey, who was good friends with the Friendly Road Inn's owner, Bob Shaw. Stamey had been smoking hogs and selling his Lexington-style Q since the 1930s, but hush puppies weren't originally part of his offerings. Stamey's son Keith believed that his dad picked up the idea of serving the side from Shaw. And while Stamey wasn't the first to marry hush puppies and barbecue, he helped solidify the combination that is now ubiquitous in North Carolina restaurants. Today, hush puppies are found on just about every good Southern menu, from glowing cookout drive-thrus to the elegant Farrington House restaurant in Pittsboro. Chefs across the South have gotten creative with the staple side, including varieties made with apples, dusted with sugar, stuffed with jalapenos, and even baked hush puppies. No need to panic. Just follow the scent of fried fish or smoked pork, and the original can't be too far away. The picture here shows in Calabash, you'll find lightly breaded, perfectly fried bounties piled high in baskets and on platters. And they show an image of the intracoastal waterway there at Calabash, where the shrimp boats are docking and restaurants along the side there. There's a little side article here called Fresh and Fried. In Johnston County, one grist mill has been making cornmeal longer than the states have been united. Atkinson's Mill in Selma began grinding grain in 1757 and hasn't stopped yet. In 1971, longtime employee Ray Wheeler, also known as the Cornbread Man, bought and expanded the business, which now offers products like cornbread mix, seafood breader, and the popular Sweet Betsy Hush Puppy mix. The mix is named after Ray's wife, who started bagging cornmeal in the 1950s and eventually helped him run the business while raising their six children. Betsy was known to be a talented and generous cook, feeding everyone who came to visit the mill. Though she died in 2019, her hush puppies continue to find new fans. For more information about Atkinson Milling, check out atkinsonmilling.com. And another side article here about hush puppies. The pig and a puppy. For years, hush puppies have known their place. They play a supporting role to the star performance, which is barbecue. But in the 1980s, at a King's restaurant counter inside Kinston Piggly Wiggly, a deep fry innovator thought outside the bun. The manager of this King's outpost, Faye Lewis, had customers asking for the cornbread for which the other King location had become known. With only a deep fryer at her disposal, Lewis shaped cornmeal into a bun and dropped it into the hot oil, and out came the soon-to-be most popular vehicle for chopped queue this side of U.S. Highway 258. More than 40 years later, the pig and a puppy sandwich is still one of the most sought-after items on the restaurant's menu, proving that you can indeed teach an old dog new tricks. And King's Restaurant is located on East Newbern Road in Kinston, off Highway 70, at kingsbbq.com for more information. And the page, of course, at the beginning shows a basket full of different shaped hush puppies. Whether you prefer them round or oblong, a hill of hush puppies is too tasty to toss to the dogs. Our next article is entitled Tracks in the Sand. It's part of the Ramblin' Man series in the magazine each month. For the rambling kids, no training ground better captured the freedom and infinite possibilities of learning to drive than the beaches at Cape Lookout National Seashore. One at a time, they sat in the driver's seat, perched on a boat cushion so they could see over the steering wheel. I slid over close to work the brakes and gas. At their ages, maybe 11 and 8, Marky and Jack couldn't yet reach the truck pedals in their flip-flopped feet. In my defense and theirs, let me just say, they weren't technically driving, but don't tell them that. To this day, my kids will swear they learned to drive on the beach at Cape Lookout, with the headlights slashing through the night as a truck bounced and jounced on the sand, all four windows wide open, the stereo blasting Bon Jovi. To this day, I can't bear here living on a prayer without being carried back to Cape Lookout and thinking, those were some of my finer parenting moments. I suspect that many of us bent the rules a bit, whether you drove on a farm path or a lonely gravel road or a wide-open parking lot after hours. I bet that most of us were behind the wheel a bit before the legal age, just to get the feel of things. For me, my first chariot was a chartreuse Ford Pinto hatchback. Stick-shift, of course. A family friend took me out when I was 15, maybe, and I signed up for driver's ed. I lurched and stalled and ground the gears. When I finally got the hang of the clutch and barked the Pinto into first gear, I thought I was a freaking astronaut. I loved to drive. A few years later, when I was good and legal, my buddy Phil Gullidge and I devised a Friday night ritual that still resonates through my love of back roads and shortcuts. Phil had a red VW Bug, and I'd graduated to the family's Pinto station wagon, royal blue with genuine synthetic wood paneling on the side. We would take off from a fixed point and navigate by two rules. We'd drive to the end of the road and then alternate with a left turn or a right turn. If the road hadn't teed within 10 minutes at the wheel, we'd take the next corresponding right or left. We cruised through Guilford and Randolph and Davidson counties with only Discovery in mind. We weren't rocking to Bon Jovi in those days, more like Boston and Styx. But that sense of freedom and possibility that fueled me down dirt roads and county highways, I could see it on Marky and Jack's faces in the glow of the Silverado at Silverado's dashboard lights. The two-track sand road at Cape Lookout National Seashore was little more than a trail, really, a winding route behind the dunes. These days, the island is far too popular for such shenanigans, but 15 years ago, we would drive for miles and not see another vehicle, especially at night. Even then, the outlines of the kids' future driving personas were apparent. In the sand, Marky was restrained and controlled. Brown as a berry with a conch shell necklace and sun-bleached hair, she steered the truck along the ruts, slowing down at each curve, intent and focused. Jack was all testosterone. Wild-eyed and howling, he jacked the steering wheel back and forth like a starfighter with Darth Vader in his sights. He was convinced that he was in control, although the kids didn't realize they were hardly driving. You had to work hard to get the truck to hop out of the ruts, but Jack did it, of course. Mired the truck in deep sand, always pushing the limits, that one. Which is why years later, Marky got to drive the ragtop Wrangler, Jeep Wrangler, and Jack didn't. Those miles on the Cape Lookout beaches kicked off a tradition for the kids and me. At my hunting camps in Johnston and Nash counties, as soon as the truck tires left the blacktop, they were jonesing to get behind the wheel. Out came the boat cushion. Eventually, they would reach the pedals unassisted, and eventually they would, indeed, be in control. For the most part. Once, within weeks of my buying a new truck, Marky and I were down on my hunting farm checking out the turkey woods. She was behind the wheel, of course, when we crossed a small creek that ran through a culvert under the road. A small piece of rebar had been pounded into the side of the road to mark the creek, and Marky steered too close, raking the metal pole. The scratch line ran along the driver's side from headlight to taillight. Marky was distraught. A brand new truck, gouged and gouged but good. The screech of rebar on metal had been like nails on a chalkboard. We got out to take a look at the damage. Yowza. She was on the verge of tears, so I bundled her up with a hug. "Sweetie," I said, "if a man is going to let his 12-year-old drive his new pickup truck, he's got to be ready to handle the consequences." I let her back in the driver's seat, and she continued haltingly through the woods. I never got the scratch fixed. Mark couldn't know then, nor could Jack, what was really happening on those Cape Lookout sand roads and eastern North Carolina farm paths. They thought I was letting them drive, but sitting there, shoulder to shoulder with my children, their hair blowing in my face, letting them color just outside the lines, whooping and laughing, they couldn't know. I was the one having the ride of my life. In the last few seconds here, we'll talk about a couple of little things that have washed ashore. During World War II, at least 90 German Allied and merchant ships sank off the North Carolina coast, an area now called the Graveyard of the Atlantic. In 2008, the remains of what is now believed to be a 1600s British Navy vessel are exposed during a winter storm in Kerala, likely the oldest shipwreck ever found on the Outer Banks. A trailer-sized shipping container full of Doritos falls into the ocean in 2006, resulting in thousands of bags of Cool Ranch, nacho cheese, and spicy nacho chips washing ashore on Hatteras Island. Well, the music says we've run out of time for today's episode of Our State Magazine. I hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Martha Potter, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired, and this broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. For questions or comments, give us a call at 919-832-5138. So long till next time.